Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
I will call this esteemed group to order. Hello, everyone. Welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. This program is part of the club's ethics and accountability series underwritten by the Charles Travers family. I'm Janet Napolitano, president of the University of California, and your moderator for the program. Few issues are more timely or more challenging than free speech on our nation's college campuses. A recent wave of controversial speakers and forms of expression at American universities has reignited tensions between the need to ensure safe and inclusive learning environments and the need to protect the bedrock of free expression and academic inquiry. This evening, we will discuss the free speech challenges American college campuses are confronting, how today's students perceive the First Amendment, and the implications of these conflicts for society at large. So it's my pleasure to introduce our guest, Erwin Chemerinsky, Dean of the UC Berkeley School of Law and co-author of the new book, Free Speech on Campus. Prior to his role at UC Berkeley, Dean Chemerinsky was the founding dean and distinguished professor of law at the UC Irvine School of Law. Dean Chemerinsky is a noted constitutional scholar and is an advisory board co-chair for the University of California's new National Center for Free Speech and Civic Engagement. This year, National Jurist magazine once again named him as the most influential person in legal education in the United States. So please join me in welcoming Dean Chemerinsky.
Thank you.
So let me begin, Dean, by asking, why this book? Why now? What prompted you and Howard Gilman to take this topic on?
Let me start by saying how honored I am to be part of this conversation and get to do this with you this evening. 2 years ago, Howard Gilman and I co-taught a freshman undergraduate seminar at the University of California, Irvine, on free speech on campus. We began each topic by posing a problem to our students and polling them. That's a technique I often use to get students engaged. And the first class, we began with a story of what had occurred a year earlier in March of 2015 at the University of Oklahoma. You might remember reading about it. It was a group of fraternity members who were on a bus together. They were all in formal wear. Two fraternity members stood up and led a very offensive racist chant. One of the fraternity members took a phone out, photographed it, and the video went viral. When University of Oklahoma President David Boren saw the video, he immediately expelled those two students and suspended the fraternity from operating on campus. We asked our students, if those who'd been expelled had sued, who should win? The expelled students based on a free speech claim or the University of Oklahoma? 15-0, our students voted for the University of Oklahoma. Not one of our students was willing to argue that what they did, though offensive, was protected by the First Amendment. We discovered throughout the course of the class that the students were overwhelmingly on the side of punishing speech and remarkably trustful of campus officials to decide what speech to allow and what to prohibit. We realized that they knew very little about the history of free speech. This is the first generation from a young age to be taught that bullying is wrong. They've internalized the message. They want to, in a very laudable way, create an inclusive learning environment for all students. But they had little sense of the history of speech or of the consequences of censorship. So we decided that we wanted to write a relatively short book talking about this history and talking about what we think campuses can and can't, shouldn't be doing right now.
So share with the audience, if you would, a few of the moments in the evolution of free speech doctrine in the United States. How did we get from the adoption of the First Amendment to where we are today?
If you haven't studied this history, you might be surprised that the United States Supreme Court's first major decision about freedom of speech didn't come until 1919. Now, why would that be? Well, the Bill of Rights were originally thought to apply only to the federal government. It wasn't until the adoption of the 14th Amendment in 1868 that the Bill of Rights began to be applied to state and local governments. In fact, freedom of speech under the First Amendment was first applied by the Supreme Court to state and local governments in 1925. The federal government was relatively limited in its activities, though there were certainly some that restricted speech. In the late 1790s, Congress passed the Alien and Sedition Act that made it a federal crime to falsely criticize the government or government officials. Individuals who were critical of the John Adams administration were imprisoned for speech milder than you'd hear on late-night shows every day. During the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln jailed people who were criticized the way the North was fighting the Civil War. But in 1919, the Supreme Court first dealt with free speech. In a very famous opinion, Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes said that there's no right to falsely shout fire in a crowded theater. The government can punish speech if there's a clear and present danger of harm. Over much of the 20th century, the Supreme Court wasn't very speech protective at all. In the early 1950s, the court upheld the ability of the government to punish those who were seen as advocating communism. But in the 1960s, this began to change. For the last half century, the Supreme Court has been very protective of speech. And I would say at this moment, one place you can find consensus among both liberals and conservatives in the court is often in these free speech cases.
So what has driven that evolution, do you think? Is it the differences in the times? Is it differences among who's in the court? I mean, what's been the propelling factor here?
It's a great question. I think history and learning from it has been very important. When we look back at American history, we so often see that the efforts to restrict speech really didn't make us any safer or any better. I mentioned the cases from 1919. They involved a couple of statutes that Congress adopted during World War I that made it a crime to criticize the draft or the war effort. The case I alluded to, with Justice Holmes' opinion, was called Schenck versus the United States. What he did was circulate a leaflet in which he argued that the military draft was involuntary servitude in violation of the 13th Amendment. His leaflet was titled, "Do Not Submit to Intimidation." There wasn't a scrap of evidence that his leaflet had the slightest effect on military induction of the war. But for just doing that and nothing else, he was sentenced to 10 years in prison, and the Supreme Court upheld the sentence. The same year, 1919, the court upheld a conviction of Eugene Debs, the socialist leader. He gave a speech to an audience of college students in which he said, "You are good for more than cannon fodder. There's more I'd like to say, but I can't for fear that I'll be imprisoned." For just saying that, he was convicted and sentenced to 10 years in prison. He ran for president while in prison. The case I mentioned from the 1950s, a case called Dennis versus the United States, involved four individuals who were convicted of violating a federal law, the Smith Act, for teaching four works of Marx and Lenin, works that today are regularly studied in college classes. They were convicted of the crime of conspiracy to advocate the overthrow of the United States government, and the Supreme Court upheld their conviction, their prison sentences. I think our society has learned from this history that repressing speech doesn't make us any safer, that in fact we're worse off when we do that. And I think that's why the current court has so come to embrace both liberals and conservatives freedom of speech.
You know, you're dean at Berkeley, which is famous for being the home of the free speech movement. What was happening at Berkeley at the time, and why is that movement considered so important now?
One of the interesting and enjoyable things of researching for this book was going back and not only reading about, but looking at the pictures from the free speech movement in the mid-1960s. And my guess is that some of you in this room were at Berkeley in the mid-1960s and can describe it. But one of the things that I didn't know is that what it was about was the ability of college students to engage in speech unrelated to university activities. In fact, among the leaders of the free speech movement were Republican students who wanted to be able to engage in campus activities related to the 1964 Republican convention. And the campus wanted to have a rule that said that only speech that related to university activities could occur. There were, of course, sit-ins in the president's office and the chancellor's office. When Ronald Reagan announced that he was going to run for governor in 1966, he spoke specifically of wanting to clean up what was going on at Berkeley. And one of the first things he did after being elected was fire Clark Kerr.
Okay, not a good precedent.
No. But that's the history of the free speech movement.
Right. So it was acknowledging the rights of students to speak out. But that's 50 years ago. How have, in your understanding, how have students' understandings of the free speech movement changed, or how have the circumstances changed?
It's interesting that at the Berkeley campus or other campus at that time, is very much about students asserting their right to speak and often administrators trying to stop it. Today, there's an interesting flip might be the right word. A lot of students now would favor restricting speech. There was a study done by the Pew Research Institute that said that 40% of undergraduates surveyed believe that offensive or racist speech should be able to be stopped on campus. I certainly have seen on the Berkeley campus, among students in the law school and on campus, many who would say the campus should be able to prohibit hateful and offensive speakers. And it was our chancellor, Carol Crist, who very much and very admirably stood up for free speech.
So, the university is caught between two seemingly contradictory values. One is a value on free speech, academic freedom, freedom of expression. The other is a value on inclusivity and mutual respect, diversity, et cetera. And how does a university go about negotiating its way between that seeming conflict?
You're right. That's the crucial question. And there obviously is no easy answer. The university has to protect free speech. For a public university, the First Amendment requires it. I think for all universities, it's central to, as you refer to it, academic freedom. At the same time, the campus has to be an inclusive learning environment for all students. The basic answer to your question is the campus cannot create inclusivity by suppressing speech based on ideas or views expressed. The essential principle of the First Amendment is that all ideas and views can be expressed, no matter how offensive. Campuses have to find ways to create inclusivity that's consistent with that. And there's many things that they can do, and we can talk about them. I think campuses need to teach students how to engage in more speech. The best remedy for the speech we don't like, Justice Holmes said, is more speech. There was an incident at Texas A&M where the white supremacist Richard Spencer was going to speak. And the campus helped to organize, the students really responsible, a major counter demonstration in the large stadium. And I've talked to both faculty and students who are at Texas A&M town, and they talk about how that counter demonstration was tremendously unifying for the campus. I think the campus officials have to speak out against hate speech. We had an incident at UC Berkeley Law School where Harvard Law professor Alan Dershowitz spoke a couple of months ago. And it was tense, but without incident. That afternoon, somebody went and drew a swastika over his picture that was on a poster on a law school bulletin board. The next morning, first thing, I put out a letter to all faculty, staff, and students condemning that hate speech and talking about how it's inconsistent with the kind of community we are and aspire to be. Campus officials have the responsibility to speak out. Campus officials have to listen to the students who have traditionally been excluded and think about what things can be done to make the campus hospitable to them. It's just we can't make the campus hospitable by censoring speech.
So what about this notion of having safe spaces or trigger warnings, terms that have been used pejoratively in the last few years. But does that go into this kind of inclusivity analysis?
Sure, it does. Let me take each of those concepts you mentioned, starting with safe spaces. I think we should be very careful by what we mean with the phrase safe spaces. If what we mean is the obligation of the university to ensure the physical safety of students, staff, and faculty, that's a legal as well as an ethical obligation. If what we mean by safe spaces is repose, a place where people can go and rest, I think campuses have that duty as well. So I think campuses can have much more in the way of restrictions of speech in dormitories than in public areas of the campus, so long as restrictions are viewpoint neutral. We all need a place of repose. I believe that campuses should have things like African-American student unions or Latino student unions as a place for repose. But if safe spaces means we're going to censor speech on campus that makes students feel uncomfortable, that can never be allowed. We can't create safe spaces by protecting people from ideas and views that they find offensive. Because part of coming to a university is being exposed to things that make us uncomfortable and might even offend us. The other concept you mentioned is trigger warnings. Trigger warnings where a professor informs students before covering offensive material that they might be upset by it. When Howard Gilman and I read to our students the chant from that bus at the University of Oklahoma, before we did so, we said, we're going to be reading you the exact words. It's highly offensive. It's racist. It speaks of lynching in a positive manner. There's nothing wrong with giving students that. Where I have concern is if a campus tried to mandate trigger warnings. There was a proposal at one point, University of California, Santa Barbara. There's a proposal at Oberlin College that professors would be required to do it. I think then you're really interfering with the academic freedom of professors. Faculty have to decide how best to cover material. Sometimes as a professor, I'm going to give trigger warnings. Sometimes I think in order for the students to understand it, they need to hear it, and then we can talk about it.
You know, in the book, you talk about kind of a professional zone for free speech versus a free speech zone. What did you mean by that? What's the difference that you're getting at there?
There are places in a university where there has to be content-based evaluation of speech. When we're considering whether to promote or tenure a faculty member, we're obviously evaluating the faculty member's scholarship, and we're seeing whether it's of sufficient quality to merit promotion or tenure. When I grade a student's paper, I'm looking at the content of what the student wrote. Now, hopefully in all of these instances, we're never discriminating based on ideology. In grading, I don't care if students take liberal or conservative positions. I want to see how they defend their views, but I'm evaluating content. And if a professor is writing content that's inadequate, if it's not very good, we can't promote or tenure. If a student's paper isn't very good, I have to give the student a poor grade. And that's all acceptable. But then there's another zone apart from that professional zone. And think about a professor who over the weekend might participate in activities that some find offensive, or a student who participates in those activities over the weekend. I don't believe that a professor should ever be able to be punished for the activities that he or she participates on the weekend, or a student for the speech activities he or she is engaged in. That's not something the university should be able to punish.
So lots of questions arise, but your book was written before Charlottesville. Mm-hmm. How would you assess what happened in Charlottesville, and how would you address some of the issues that were raised by that demonstration?
Sure. I think so many things happened at Charlottesville. We need to separate what we're talking about. One thing is the signs that were held up at Charlottesville. If you haven't read them, you should. They're so deeply offensive. One of the signs said, and I quote verbatim, "Kikes belong in the oven." I'm 64 years old. I've never seen a sign like that held up in public. It felt then to read it, even to say it now, like a punch in the stomach. But the First Amendment protects the right for people to say that, and somebody couldn't be punished for that. A second thing that happened at Charlottesville was the march with those torches. As you and I were mentioning, the University of Virginia and Charlottesville had a rule that prohibited carrying fire in that way. The campus could prohibit that in enforcing a viewpoint neutral rule. You can't have fire on campus. There's good reasons for that. That they didn't do. A third thing about Charlottesville was they didn't have adequate police there to make sure that the demonstrators and the counter-demonstrators were separate. And one of the things that has been learned by campuses is it's very important to have sufficient law enforcement so that there's safety. And of course, a final thing that I mentioned about Charlottesville was an act of terrorism. A man drove his car into the demonstrators and killed somebody. That's not protected by the Constitution or speech. That's an act of violence, of terrorism, and had to be punished as such.
So you mentioned they didn't have adequate law enforcement presence. Now, in contrast, during Free Speech Week at Berkeley this fall, when a fellow named Milo Yiannopoulos was going to be at Sproul Plaza, he had invited Steve Bannon and Ann Coulter and other similar speakers. And so the university, anticipating a lot of protest activity, went out of its way to retain a lot of law enforcement presence at significant cost to the university. Was that the right call? And what is the how does the law take into account wanting to have free speech and yet the cost associated with having that free speech?
There's two questions there. The answer to the first is absolutely. The answer to the second is the law hasn't answered that question yet. Let me deal them one at a time. Ben Shapiro, a conservative commentator, announced he wanted to speak on campus, and there's great concern about how it might be disrupted. Chancellor Carol Crist spent $600,000 to ensure that Ben Shapiro could speak successfully, but there would be no violence or disruptions. And that's exactly what happened. Ben Shapiro was able to speak on campus. There was no violence or disruptions. I think that Chancellor Crist made exactly the right call in ensuring that there was speech and there was also safety. But then we get to your second question. Where's the line to be drawn? What if it wasn't one night or one week? What if it was over the course of a semester they said, every week we're going to have speakers that require that kind of safety? Where is the place at which a university can say, we can't afford to be able to protect the speaker and the audience and provide for safety, so we have no choice but to cancel the speaker? And that's the place that the law doesn't provide us an answer yet. And there can be a place at which a campus can say, we just can't afford this anymore. But hopefully that's a last resort, and it can never be based on wanting to stop a particular viewpoint from being expressed.
So it needs to be so-called content neutral.
That's right.
You would say there would need to be a fairly dramatic showing by the campus about the impact of cost, because there's a trade-off here. There's only so many dollars, and you know, some would argue those dollars would better be spent having speakers who are real academics, so to speak, or sponsoring a real academic debate.
I heard Chancellor Crist say that she estimates the campus has spent about $2 million this semester on protecting safety while allowing speakers. At a time of a budget crisis, there's a lot educational that can be done with that $2 million. But I also think at this point she made the right choice. When I had the great pleasure of talking to her and I said the law is uncertain here, I said, if I were your lawyer, and of course I'm not, she has campus counsel for that, I would say you face two questions. First, what's your stomach for getting sued? Given that the law is uncertain, if you exclude a speaker on this basis, you'll get sued. You might lose, and then you'll have to pay the other side's attorney's fees. And the second question is, what do you want your message to be right now? And as I said, I think she rightly said that the message she wanted right now was that Berkeley should be known as a free speech campus, and she would spend the money to allow the speech and protect safety. But that doesn't answer the underlying question that you pose.
Yeah. So that may be a court case to come.
Undoubtedly will.
Uh-huh.
This is faced by campuses all over the country right now.
Right, right. Going back to student viewpoints now, Where do you think students are getting their understanding of the First Amendment? And how do you think we should be educating students to the values implicit in the First Amendment?
It's a great question. I've taught an undergraduate class since 1989, every year up until this one, at University of Southern California, and then at Duke, and then at UCI. And I'm stunned by how little my undergraduates know about the history of free speech, or more generally about the Constitution. I think we do a terrible job in our country at civics education. I worry about the long-term consequences of that. And so one of the things that I hope this center that you so wonderfully created will do is think about what can we do better with regard to civic education so students know the history of free speech in this country and students realize that free speech has been integral to every advancement of civil rights. Abolition of slavery, giving women the right to vote, the end of Jim Crow, all of that in large part was the product of speech and demonstrations.
You know, there's some writers out there today who critique today's students as being coddled and that they want to huddle in their safe spaces and not engage and that they are incapable of any kind of resilience. What's your take on that?
I strongly disagree. And as I say, having taught undergraduates the free speech class the last couple of years, and I taught them overall for more than 25 years, I have tremendous admiration for this generation of college students. And I think to the extent they want to see restrictions of speech, it's out of the most laudable motives. They want to create an inclusive learning environment for all of the students on campus. I think the problem is that we can't do that by suppressing speech. That's not going to achieve their goals, and ultimately I worry it will be counterproductive. If we give the campus officials the power to pick and choose what speech to allow and what speech to prohibit, it's not going to come out the way they want a lot of the time.
So you mentioned in your earlier remarks that, and it's in the book too, that today's generation of students grew up in a very anti-bullying atmosphere, that speech that is bullying speech is not acceptable. How do you square that kind of teaching with the free speech views you're expressing tonight?
That's a great question. Bullying is wrong. Harassment is wrong, even though it occurs through speech. Let me take harassment as an example. Imagine an employer says to an employee, sleep with me or you're fired, and the employer gets sued for sexual harassment. It would be no defense that any court would accept to say it was only words. Moreover, courts have said that speech can create a hostile environment, harassment, and can be actionable. And the same applies on college campuses. Now, where we draw the line is the hard question. Generally, it has to be directed at a particular person or so pervasive to materially interfere with educational opportunities based on race, sex, religion, sexual orientation. Let me give examples to make this less abstract. There was an incident, as you know, at the University of California, San Diego, where somebody draped a noose, or appeared to be it, over a tree branch in the middle of campus. Terribly offensive, vile, but no court would regard that to be harassment. But imagine that somebody tacked what appeared to be a noose on a door in a dormitory of a room of an African-American student. That would be regarded as harassment. So even though it could be regarded as a form of speech, it wouldn't be protected by the First Amendment. So when the speech crosses the line to harassment, crosses the line to bullying, then it's not protected by the Constitution.
Because it's individually directed, and what role does intent have there?
Well, it's an interesting question. The court has also said that true threats are not protected by the First Amendment, and the federal courts of appeals are split of, does it have to be that the speaker desired to threaten the audience, or is it enough that the audience felt threatened? I actually take the latter position, saying there should be no First Amendment right to cause a person to reasonably fear for imminent harm to his or her physical safety. I think likewise with regard to harassment, if the reasonable person would feel unwelcome, harassed, for the reasonable person to materially interfere with educational opportunity, that's not speech protected by the First Amendment. I recognize there's a hard line drawing issue there, but it's one we face all the time in the context of the workplace.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
So, how would you explain how the Department of Education Office of Civil Rights is navigating these free speech issues in the context of current federal law?
I could have answered that much better prior to January 20th of this year, because I could have talked much more about what the Office of Civil Rights was doing then. We have less sense of what the Office of Civil Rights is going to be doing under the new administration because it hasn't done that. Catherine Lehman was the Assistant Secretary for Education for Civil Rights in the Department of Education under the Obama administration, and she convened a national gathering in Chicago of educators, and I had the chance to go speak on this topic with them. And I think that they were struggling to draw exactly this distinction. I think the Office of Civil Rights was trying to be very protective of speech to the point where it became harassment, true threats, incitement. I'm not sure where the Office of Civil Rights is going to be now, or for that matter, where the Justice Department is. Attorney General Sessions gave a very famous speech at Georgetown University saying that there's so much suppression of speech on campus. There isn't so much suppression of speech on campus. Walk across the Berkeley campus any day, and you see countless people out there engaged in speech. I'm not sure what they're speaking about, but it's going on all the time. And that's true of every campus. I think it's so important not to generalize from the anecdotes. And so I think the Office of Civil Rights, at least up till now, has been trying to draw that balance.
So you mentioned the University of California's new National Center for Free Speech and Civic Engagement, and you are co-chairing the advisory committee with Howard Gilman, the chancellor at Irvine, who is your co-author of this book. Talk to me about your vision for this center and what it can accomplish.
I was so thrilled when you decided to create this center and so honored to be the co-chair of the advisory board. The reality is, surprisingly, there's nothing like it at any university in the country. A university-based research institute to look at issues of speech and civic engagement. There's a private organization, FIRE, but it has its agenda. There's certainly wonderful organizations like the AAUP. There's the Knight Center at Columbia University. It's really focused on press. But I see this, as I said, is university-based examining these issues. Well, what does that mean? It means that I hope that this center is going to engage in research, including empirical research. We don't really have much research, but what's actually happening in terms of campuses, in terms of speech, in terms of punishment of speech, there's not even that much in terms of surveys of student and faculty attitudes with regard to speech. We have the ability to do it. There's no agenda for this center, just gathering information and accurately presenting it. I think there's a need to have conferences and symposia on these topics where all viewpoints are present. Once more, there's no agenda. But to then be able to advance knowledge, I think we can put out white papers and we can put out books and we can educate university presidents, state legislatures, the general public on these issues. So I'm just so thrilled to be part of it.
So if you were writing a roadmap for university presidents today in terms of do's and don'ts on navigating free speech, inclusivity, education, debate, etc. What would you line out as the do's and don'ts?
Sure. And I should say here that if you're kind enough to get the book, chapter 5 is written in exactly that way. It's campuses can do this, can't do this, and we equate that with what shouldn't do it as well. Just as examples, campuses can't have viewpoint restrictions with regard to speech. All ideas and views can be expressed on a college campus, period. But campuses can have time, place, and manner restrictions so long as they leave adequate places for communication. Even when there's a First Amendment right to speak, it doesn't mean it can be exercised at any time, at any place, in any manner. There's a First Amendment right to use public streets for speech, but that doesn't mean there's a First Amendment right to go into the middle of a freeway at rush hour and hold a demonstration. So for campuses, time, place, and manner restrictions can be used to prevent disruption of campus activities and also to protect safety. As an example, a campus can say no demonstrations in or near classroom buildings while classes are in session. Campuses can have free speech zones so long as they leave adequate places for communication. Campuses can use time, place, and manner restrictions, as I said, for purpose of safety. When I was asked by the campus officials at Berkeley for advice, I said, have the most controversial speakers speak inside auditoriums rather than the public area of campus. I think that's a permissible time, place, manner restriction. And the reason for that is if you have the speakers in an auditorium, you can require tickets or ID to get in. You can have metal detectors at the door. You can have police secure the perimeter. Once it's outside in the middle of campus, it's much harder to do that. That's an example of a time, place, and manner restriction. In fact, Berkeley did that. It had Ben Shapiro speak in the largest auditorium, Zellerbach Hall. He couldn't object to that. That was a permissible, constitutionally acceptable way to deal with this.
So I want to turn to some questions, and we have quite a few from the audience. But what role do you think social media plays in this and activities that take place on social media?
I think the hardest free speech issues that are going to come up are going to involve social media. To start with, the model that you and I began talking about in terms of the free speech movement thinks of speech that goes on campus, and to what extent can the campus regulate that? When you're dealing with social media, that distinction of on-campus versus off-campus has no meaning. You're talking about speech that's going on in somebody's dormitory room or apartment. The internet is probably the most powerful medium for communication to be developed since the printing press. It has tremendously democratized the ability to reach a mass audience. It used to be to reach a mass audience, you had to be rich enough to own a newspaper or get a broadcast license. Now, anyone in this room with a smartphone or even just access to a modem in a public library can reach a mass audience. But that then raises really difficult questions. We know, for example, that through the internet there can be disclosure of very private information about somebody. Have you heard the phrase doxing that's going on campus, revealing who's transgender or who's undocumented, revenge porn that goes on through the internet? There's harassment, people getting targeted through the internet for vile harassment. And we know this tends to be more women students and more minority students. Well, when and how can campuses punish that speech over the internet, given that it's going on off campus? Those, I think, are going to be the hardest free speech issues to come up in the years ahead.
And so if you were the judge and that case was put before you, how would you resolve it?
Okay, tell me which case.
The case. So
it's very specific to the context.
You are asked to decide whether a student should be punished for violating a student code of conduct for a vile posting on the internet.
If the posting is vile because it's racist or sexist or anti-Semitic or homophobic, no, the student shouldn't be punished. There's a right to express those views. But imagine what the student does is revenge porn. Imagine two students were in a relationship, sexually explicit video is taken, and one student posts it about another student. That's not speech protected by the First Amendment. I think that could be punished. Or imagine a situation where a student reveals about another student that student is undocumented or that student's transgender. I don't think that that's speech protected by the First Amendment. That's publicly disclosing very private facts. I think that speech can be punished. And that's going on too. And so it is a question of where do you draw those lines?
Right, right. What about actions by students to shout down a speaker, to interrupt an ongoing presentation and the like? How do you deal with those?
And this has come up a lot this fall. There was an incident at William and Mary Law School at the end of September where a lawyer for the ACLU was coming to speak, and a group of students from campus came and shouted so loud that the speaker was never able to address the audience. There was an incident soon after at the University of Oregon where Michael Schill, the president, was giving a speech on the state of the campus, and a group of disruptors came in so he couldn't be heard. There was an incident at UC Irvine a number of years ago while I was still there where Israeli Ambassador Michael Oren was speaking, and a group of students in turn shouted so that he couldn't be heard. In fact, 11 students did this one after another. There is no First Amendment right to use speech to silence others. So those who shouted down the ACLU lawyer or President Schill or Ambassador Oren were not protected in what they were doing by freedom of speech. Otherwise, there would always be a heckler's veto. Otherwise, the only speech that would be allowed is that which nobody cared enough to shout down. And so I think that the law here is clear, that there isn't a First Amendment right to use speech to disrupt other invited speakers.
So a question from the audience. Are there any examples of the incitement exception that colleges can use to protect their students when deliberately incendiary speakers want to come to campus to speak?
Sure. In order to answer that question, it's important to be clear about the legal test for incitement. It comes from a Supreme Court case in 1969, Brandenburg versus Ohio, and the Supreme Court said that speech can be punished if there's both a substantial likelihood of imminent illegal activity and if the speech is directed at causing imminent illegal activity. So it has to be both. There's a substantial likelihood of it, and the speech has to be directed at advocating that it occur. Could I come up with an example of that? Sure. Imagine that there's an angry crowd on campus. Imagine that a speaker exhorts the crowd to go out and commit acts of vandalism and violence to protest whatever it is they're talking about. I think that speaker could be convicted of incitement. Contrast that to another situation. Imagine a very controversial speaker is coming onto campus, Milo Yiannopoulos, Richard Spencer, Ann Coulter. And imagine it's foreseeable that there's going to be a reaction against that speaker. That's not incitement. Most in this audience might remember in the late 1970s, early 1980s, the Nazi Party wanted to march through Skokie, Illinois. It was then a predominantly Jewish suburb of Chicago with a large number of Holocaust survivors. And Skokie said, the Nazi presence here is going to incite the audience. Every court to rule, including the Supreme Court, said the Nazis had the right to be there. The reaction of the audience can't be the basis for suppressing the speaker. To be incitement, there has to be substantial likelihood that it will lead to illegal activity, and the speaker has to be directing the speech, intending to advocate imminent illegal activity.
Well, that leads to this next audience question. How can a university convince those who are offended that what offends them is, in fact, necessary and healthy speech or expression of ideas?
Great question. My answer is to try to explain to the students that the only way that their speech will be safe tomorrow is to expect speech that they don't like today. That we don't need the First Amendment to protect the speech that we like. We would let that go on anyway. What we need the First Amendment for is to protect the speech we don't like. And the question that I ask them is, do they really trust those who are in power to pick and choose as to what speech to allow and what speech to prohibit? And do they want those who are in power in government now to have that kind of authority?
I think I know the answer to that. Given the cost of tuition, Do you believe that students believe that they may have a right to limit speech on campus because they are consumers of education? What do you think?
Students are consumers of education. The question is, what conclusion to draw from that? They don't have a right to limit speech on campus. For a public university, the First Amendment applies, and the First Amendment says that the campus cannot restrict speech based on views or ideas. Even if it's expensive, the campus has an obligation to facilitate speech. Where that obligation ends, where to draw the line, as we said, we don't know. But I think it's a clever argument by the students, but it's not one that any court would accept.
So according to the Brookings Institute, 19% of college-aged individuals believe violence is permissible to shut down a political speaker they do not like. How do you evaluate that statistic? How do you think about groups like the Antifa that propagate this sentiment?
I find it very frightening, because I find violence always to be very frightening. I also think it's ahistorical. Imagine that this was the early 1960s, and imagine it was those engaged in lunch counter sit-ins to protest segregation. Does that then mean it would be okay to engage in violence against them to stop them from speaking? Or think of those who were protesting the Vietnam War, including at Kent State. Is it okay to use violence to shut them down? Or, of course, the students don't think back to this. Think of the labor marches, where there was attempts by the violence to shut down the labor unions from being able to organize and protest. Once we open that door, it's not just going to be that those who engage in violence are going to get to stop the speech they don't like. They're then legitimating violence being used against the very speech they want to engage in.
So it's a very unhealthy,
to say the least.
Here's a question that goes to the heart of the matter. Who decides what is hate speech?
Okay. To answer this question, you need to know that the United States Supreme Court has been clear that hate speech is speech protected by the Constitution. I mentioned the example of Skokie. There was a Supreme Court case in 1992, RAV versus City of St. Paul. St. Paul, Minnesota adopted an ordinance prohibiting painting a swastika or burning a cross in a manner likely to anger, alarm, or cause resentment. 9-0, the Supreme Court declared that ordinance unconstitutional, saying that hate speech is protected by the First Amendment. Virginia adopted a statute prohibiting cross burning. It did so in light of the vile history of cross-burning in that state. 8-1 in Virginia v. Black, 2003, the Supreme Court declared that unconstitutional. In the early 1990s, over 350 colleges and universities adopted so-called hate speech codes. Everyone to come to court, without exception, was declared unconstitutional. And so I mention this to answer the question, in that the courts don't try to say what's hate speech versus protected speech, because hate speech is protected under the First Amendment.
Speech is speech.
That's right. That's why when Auburn University tried to exclude white supremacist Richard Spencer, he went to court and he sued and he won. He got an injunction being able to speak, that a campus can't stop speech on the grounds that it's hateful.
So this brings up an interesting point. Can you describe a little bit the difference between how the United States handles speech and hate speech versus, say, Western European countries?
Great question. It's interesting. Every European country has a law that prohibits hate speech. The United States is by far the most protective of any Western nation when it comes to freedom of expression. And yet the experience in these European countries should cause us great pause before we'd embrace that approach. So often these laws are used against the very groups they're meant to protect. When England adopted its first law prohibiting hate speech, the initial group to be prosecuted under it was a Zionist group. The prosecutor said Zionism is a form of racism under United Nations resolution, so advocating for Zionism was hate speech. France has a very strict hate speech law. Do you know who's the most frequently prosecuted person, or one of the most frequently prosecuted? The actress Brigitte Bardot has been repeatedly prosecuted because her animal rights activism has caused her to criticize religions that engage in ritual sacrifice, and she's been repeatedly convicted under that law. I could go through example after example, we mentioned many in the book, of speech that we would think of as tame and ineffectual, but gets end up being punished as hate speech in foreign countries. So this experience causes me real concern about whether we'd want to go down that path. Or one more example. I mentioned the hate speech codes. The University of Michigan adopted a hate speech code after a number of very ugly incidents on campus there. Before it was declared unconstitutional by the court, every prosecution under it, every attempt to enforce it, was brought against African-American and Latino students.
Is there any difference between the legal analysis of free speech on college campuses versus, say, on public high schools?
Yes. The Supreme Court has been much more deferential to high school officials in restricting speech than to college officials. The initial Supreme Court case about speech in high schools was very speech protective. In this case, you might remember, is a case called Tinker versus Des Moines Board of Education. It involved two students, a brother and a sister, John and Mary Beth Tinker, who wanted to wear black armbands to protest the Vietnam War. And the principal said it would be offensive, especially to students in the school who had brothers who had died in Vietnam or were serving in Vietnam. They wouldn't take off their armbands, and they got expelled. And the case went all the way to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court very famously ruled in favor of the students, said students don't leave their free speech rights at the schoolhouse gate. But since then, now it's almost 50 years, all of the cases have come down on the side of the ability of school officials to punish speech. The most recent was a decade ago, a case called Morse versus Frederick in 2007. It was a high school in Juneau, Alaska. The Olympic torch was coming through, and the school released the students to stand on the sidewalk and watch. A student got together with some friends and unfurled a banner that said, quote, "Bong hits for Jesus." At the oral argument, Justice Souter said he had no idea what that meant. But the principal thought that it was a message to encourage illegal drug use. She confiscated the banner and suspended the student from school. The Supreme Court ruled 5-4 for the principal, but very much on the idea that high schools are different than colleges, and high schools have an interest in stopping speech that would encourage illegal drug use. No college administrator could get away with that. It's the court really perceives a difference based on the age of the students.
So high school students don't know about bongs and college students do.
You said that, I didn't.
We have several questions here about have the courts gone too far in protecting corporate speech under the First Amendment?
I don't know how to answer that question other than yes. The key case that everyone here is familiar with was Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission in 2010 that held that corporations have the right to spend unlimited amounts of money in election campaigns to get candidates elected or candidates defeated. I'm not worried about what this is going to mean for presidential elections. There's so much money spent then anyway. I'm worried about the local elections. I'm worried about the judicial elections, where so much money can be spent and is being spent by corporations to determine the outcome of those elections. What I find ironic is that some of the justices, the majority there, are ones who said we should follow the framers' original intent. I challenge anyone to show that the framers of the First Amendment were trying to protect the ability of corporations to spend unlimited amounts of money in election campaigns. I worry how much this spending is going to distort our political system and is already doing that. So that's why my answer to that question is yes.
Putting on your kind of crystal ball hat, what do you think, what issues in the free speech, particularly on college campuses, do you think will be percolating up through the court system in the next few years? And how do you think the courts will come down?
Sure. Let me start with tomorrow, and then I'll go from there to answer your question. Tomorrow, the Supreme Court's going to hear arguments in a very important case about free speech. It's called Masterpiece Cake Shop versus Colorado Civil Rights Commission. And it involves a baker in Colorado who refused to bake a cake for a gay couple that wanted to celebrate its wedding. And there's two issues that are going to be argued in the Supreme Court tomorrow. One is, does the baker have free exercise of religion rights to not bake the cake? Interestingly, that's not going to be what the case is likely decided by, because the Supreme Court held in 1990 that people can't use their religion to get an exemption from a general law. The Colorado law prohibits sexual orientation discrimination. Under that 1990 precedent, he can't get an exemption based on his religion. It's the other argument, the speech argument, that's really the center. He says, I'm a cake artisan. To force me to bake a cake is to force me to engage in speech. Compelled speech violates the First Amendment. Now, to me, that's a very frightening argument. If baking a cake is speech, isn't cooking food speech? Then couldn't a restaurant say, you can't force us to make food for an African American because that's compelled speech? And I love to bake, but if baking a cake is speech, then, gosh, isn't any work speech? Then can't somebody claim that you can never force them to serve someone because that's compelled speech? There's always a tension between liberty and equality. Anytime we stop discrimination, we're limiting the freedom to discriminate. We've made the choice as a society that it's more important to stop discrimination than to protect freedom to engage in discrimination. But that's the underlying issue in the case being argued tomorrow. In terms of campuses, some of the issues...
And what should people listen for or watch for in the argument on that case?
Justice Kennedy's questions. My advice to any lawyers who are arguing for the Supreme Court is make your briefs a shameless attempt to pander to Anthony Kennedy. If the clerk will allow it, put Anthony Kennedy's picture on the front of your briefs. I think it's going to be 5-4 with Justice Kennedy in the majority, so that's what I would really focus on, or I will focus on tomorrow. In terms of campuses, I think that we've alluded to some of the issues that are coming up. There are cases involving when can a campus exclude a particularly hateful speaker because of the pattern of violence that ensued. Ohio State University refused to allow Richard Spencer to speak, and they did so by pointing to the pattern of violence that occurred at other campuses when Richard Spencer was present, like at the University of Virginia, like at the University of Florida. And they're saying, it's not that we're excluding him based on his views. We're excluding him because the likelihood of violence based on this pattern. I would pay careful attention to what happens in that case that's now pending in federal court in Ohio.
Well, that also ties into the issue of is there a reasonable cost limitation that a university can
exactly.
raise?
And I think that issue is going to get litigated where the campus says, we're canceling the speaker because we can't afford the security, and the speaker then sues. And then the internet issues that we've alluded to are already starting to come up, and I think we're going to see so many cases about various things in terms of when can students or faculty be punished for speech over the internet. There was a case involving the University of Illinois. There was a professor by the name of Saleta who was being hired by the University of Illinois from William & Mary, and he had a number of tweets that were very anti-Israel. And the University of Illinois then rescinded his job offer. He sued, and all we know is that the case settled. But those are the kind of things we're going to see more and more of.
And what about cases that could impose a duty on college administrators? Like, for example, if there are certain objectionable or vile chalkings on the sidewalks on the campus. Does the administration have a duty to erase those or to take down posters that have images of nooses or swastikas, et cetera? Anything like that?
Sure. Oh, very much so. Well, let me start in terms of duty. There's a case right now pending in federal court in Los Angeles involving Pierce College. And it said, we'll have a free speech zone, but it was a very tiny free speech zone. And the question is, did it violate the First Amendment? Did it have a duty to create more? I think the examples that you raise are going to be so difficult. If the campus doesn't take down the nooses or the chalkings, build the wall, then could minority students say it's a hostile environment? And if they do take them down, could the speaker say, you're censoring us and you're violating our free speech right? Is it going to be that sometimes campuses are in a damned if you do, damned if you don't, they're going to get sued either way? I think so.
Who wins?
I think it's going to depend on context and rules. Imagine the campus has a rule that says you can't use chalk on buildings or sidewalks. If they've got that rule, it's viewpoint neutral. No chalkings on sidewalks or buildings. They can take down the chalk. If the campus wants to say you can't hang anything in your dormitory window, they can keep people from having the Confederate flag or the Jimi Hendrix poster or the 2017 version of the Jimi Hendrix poster. It's neutral. If the campus tries to say no Confederate flags, but you can have the Taylor Swift poster, then that's where they violate the First Amendment. So much depends on how the rules are written and administered by the campus.
So what about a campus rule requiring student organizations to post security deposits and how those are calculated? How would you
Sure.
adjudicate those?
Let me tell you what the law is here, and then we can, I think, come to the conclusion with regard to your question. The key Supreme Court case so far is a case called Nationalist Movement versus Forsyth County in 1992. A county in Georgia said, in order to have a demonstration, you need to have a permit, and the mayor will set the fee for the permit up to $1,000. The Supreme Court declared that unconstitutional. The Supreme Court said if the mayor has discretion set the amount of the fee, and there's no limits on the discretion, there's too great a danger the mayor will set a high fee, he or she doesn't like the speech, and a low fee if the mayor does like the speech. That violates the First Amendment. Also, the fee can't be so large as to prevent the speech from occurring. Skokie tried to require that the Nazi party post an insurance bond that was so expensive they couldn't possibly speak. But this is a common principle. The government can't impose a cost on a right that's so great as to keep the right from being able to be exercised. The government can't say to women, oh, you can have an abortion, but we're going to impose $1 million tax per abortion. That would violate the Constitution. Well, likewise, you can't put a burden on the group that's so large to keep the speech. But on the other hand, if the burden on the group is content neutral and it's reasonable, it wouldn't be so large as to prevent the speech, then campuses can do that. So campuses can impose reasonable fees on student groups so long as they're not so large that they keep the speech from being able to take place.
And what about the whole issue about what qualifies as a campus organization? Who's entitled to invite a speaker to campus? You know, why don't you?
Great question. The key is the campus has to have neutral rules. A campus can say, in order to be a campus organization, you have to meet the following criteria. So long as they're viewpoint neutral, it's fine for the campus to do that. There was a Supreme Court case earlier this decade. It's called Christian Legal Society versus Martinez, and involved Hastings Law School here in San Francisco. It had a rule, as do all the UC law schools, that any student organization must be available to all comers. That our view is all students pay the student activity fee that funds the student organizations. Every student should be able to be a part of any student organization. Well, the Christian Legal Society didn't want to follow that. They only wanted those who believed in certain things, including condemning gay marriage. And Hastings said, no, we're not going to let you be a student organization unless you'll accept all students. And the Christian Legal Society sued, and they lost in the Supreme Court, with the Supreme Court saying that college and universities can have reasonable rules, like all-comer rules, saying any student organization has to be available to all students.
So I take it also that means that you have to have content-neutral rules that have to be neutrally applied.
Exactly.
Right? You can't, in implementing the rules, say, well, we'll give an exception to you and not to you, et
cetera. That's exactly right. And that's, I think, the very core of the First Amendment, is that the government has to be content-neutral.
So finish up here, Irwin. If you could share a parting message about free speech with students on campus, what would you say? And if you could share a parting message for administrators on campus, what would you say?
Every generation thinks it's the one that discovered sex. Every generation believes that it's the first to deal with these issues of free speech on campus. What I'd want both students and administrators to know is there have been issues of free speech on campus as long as there have been colleges and universities. There's certainly things that are different today than it used to be, but ultimately, as long as there are colleges and universities, there's going to be free speech issues. What I'd most want to communicate to students is history, that when we've given campus officials the authority to punish speech, they've abused it in ways we come to regret. And I'd want them to know, as I've said, the only way their speech can be secure tomorrow is to speech that they dislike today. And what I want to tell campus officials is just what we're talking about now, that whatever rules they have to be viewpoint neutral, and they have to be administered in a viewpoint neutral way. Campuses can't pick and choose to allow the message they like and stop the ones they don't.
Very good. I think we have about reached the end of our time. Do you have any final parting words for the audience?
Thank you. This has been such an enormous pleasure. Thank all of you for coming. Thank you for this terrific exchange. And thank you also for creating this new Center on Free Speech and Civic Engagement. I think it is a real chance to make an enormous difference.
There you go. Thank you very much.
Thank you. That was terrific. Thank you so much. Oh, it was wonderful.